Busy city life makes it hard to think about and work at integrating our faith with our lives. Welcome to the Cathedral Podcast, produced and hosted by Jenny Ho Huan. Each episode, we want to help you relate core Christian truths to your daily life. Whether it's science, philosophy, cultural trends, or life stories, we bring you authentic and unrehearsed conversations to spark insight and strengthen your faith and your life.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining me here. This is Jenny. You know, technology is so huge today and it's a really big conversation. We had one conversation earlier with Aaron and right now we are very grateful he came back for another round of conversation. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, Jenny.
My pleasure. In our earlier conversation, we discussed how tech actually has a moral dimension to it. If we consider what the designer intended it for or how consumers and users actually use it. And of course, there are programs written to specifically hurt, to scam. And there are users who unthinkingly allow tech to shape our minds as well as our lifestyles. So I want to continue with these moral conundrums, but move into the realm of tech, which we are all hurtling towards, which is artificial intelligence. Tell us about this thing called the black box in AI.
Okay, my pleasure. You know, in an interview with the Christian online publication Salt and Light that I did a few months ago, and that was in respect of Singapore's first digital theology conference called Christian X, I posed a very simple question, you know, should we just because we can? And this is a basic question about emerging technologies that we have to ask ourselves, but which we do not. You know, and, you know, whether you are a user of tech or someone who is working in tech, we all have, in a sense, an obligation to be ethicists, you know, posing the question always, in light of this, how then should we live? Right. That is a fundamentally an ethical question, you know.
Which and we all should be asking because we
all
are basically
ought to be asking ourselves,
moral beings, right?
Absolutely, and Christians most of all. So, you know, and we don't do it as a purely academic exercise. Although AI as an academic discipline is about 70 years old. You know, but really, we want to delve into the moral dimensions of technology and because we know that there are implications to technology. They shape us. They affect us, our families and our society. So kind of come at your question, you know, about the black box problem in AI, we can start by just observing a few things about AI generally. Okay. So AI, artificial intelligence, is also known as machine intelligence. You know, all the ways in which a machine can show human intelligence. And it's also something so interesting that it's at the heart of all our postmodern narratives. You see movies, science fiction novels, you know, speculative fiction. They all have to do with technology. And even technologists and scientists and literary people have coined a term called convergence. And people are always sort of positing when that day might come. You know, in the Terminator series of movies, they call it, what do they call it now? They call it... Not convergence, but they call it singularity.
Okay.
You know, So back to the AI and the black box problem. So the black box problem really is the issue of explainability. It is a kind of a growing pain in the development of AI, and basically it just is a recognition that if people don't know how a machine makes decisions, they won't trust it.
True.
That's at the heart of the black box problem, and AI's decision-making process is often too difficult for people to understand. And understandably, when we interact with something that we don't understand, it can cause us anxiety and make us feel like we are losing control.
Sure, but much of what we use nowadays, we don't understand. And we still use it nonetheless because we are so enamored by its powers and its abilities. And the perceived or as well as real experience that is helping us, making our life easier, entertaining us whatsoever, right? So I'm not quite following you on why this explainability is so huge.
That is a very good observation, Jenny. I think technology is quite unique in the sense that it purports to make things possible that were previously impossible.
Yep.
And so in our eagerness to embrace it, because we want our life to be easier, to be more enjoyable, we fail to actually see that in between us and the outcomes that we want or the activities that we enjoy, there is a black box. There is a whole world of programming that has not been explained to you. And therefore, you're not mindful of the implications of
But technology. I understand with AI and its potential.
Yes.
When we're talking about AI in warfare.
Yes.
AI in higher realms of human activity typically. Then I think we confront this black box a lot more because that's where we don't want to seek control.
Yes.
Yeah.
So there's there's a very simple example, personal example that I can tell you about. I don't know whether I shared it with you before, but a few years ago, I was at the Art Science Museum and they had the future of AI kind of exhibition there. And as you came into the Art Science Museum, at the reception desk, just inside the start of the exhibition, there's a robot that looked like a blonde lady.
There was. Oh, wow. Yes. Interesting.
I don't really remember. And it was there for some months, you know, throughout the duration of the exhibition. And its name was Nadine. Mm. And I found out later on that it was invented by a researcher who worked at NTU at that point in time. Wow. So it's humanoid. Okay. It has eyes and, you know, it sits down like a receptionist. And I had the pleasure to be shown around the Art Science Museum by someone who worked there. And I met this person, this robot, you know, who greeted me. And then we interacted, you know, about you know, offering me advice about what to see in the exhibition and so on. And that was, so I introduced myself to it, you know, and
you did that. And you talked to Nadine. Okay.
And it's so interesting. It was, my feeling was immediately one of like a little bit like shy. It was like, it was clearly a social interaction session, even though I knew that it was a robot. Now, this is the weird thing. About a week later, I went back and I approached the robot again. This was in the middle of the afternoon and I was by myself. I approached the robot.
Did the robot remember you?
It remembered me.
Oh,
so it said, surprised. "Hi, Aaron. How are you? It's nice to see you."
Oh, and that's facial recognition.
I was so flabbergasted. Oh my God, voice that's right. So in the background, we realized that it's a mix, you know, voice recognition, facial recognition. He greeted me. And then we had an even more awkward interaction the second time around because of this. And at one point, the robot told me, you're kind of quiet. Is everything okay?
Oh my goodness.
So you imagine the expression, the sentiment of human sympathy or
so
empathy.
So lifelike though, huh?
It's so super lifelike. It's all entirely programmed, of course.
Yes.
But it just sort of left a very lasting impression on me. So that really is, in a nutshell, some of the unease that we feel when we're interacting
That's like people playing a fool with Siri bumped out 1,000 times.
Yes. especially when the thing that is interacting with you looks like
A human being. Yes.
You know, so there are even designers of technology who nowadays ask themselves the question, you know, this thing that I'm doing, does it need to look anything like a human being? If not, don't make it look like a human being, because it immediately gives several kinds of
I think
signals.
In common parlance, people will say it's creepy.
It's creepy. It's creepy, yeah. And it can't quite, you know, there's a name for this effect, you know, but So we see that in nowadays when you have machines that maybe do hard labor, you know, they pick up heavy things and they move them around the warehouse and so on. And really, the trend now is to not make them look humanoid, because it just gives this very strange feeling to people who kind of see it.
No, but it's very strange. I think like moving heavy things around, we have this thing called a forklift.
Yeah.
I thought that should do the job.
That should do the job, shouldn't it? Yes, absolutely.
Okay, but you know, there's the other thing about the black box is also, when you talk about explainability, it's also the culpability, right?
Yes.
Let's say that humanoid Nadine decides to do something naughty, like smack your bottom or, I don't know, run away with
I wonder why you chose
run
that.
Away with
yes,
the...
okay.
I don't know. I don't know who programmed the thing, right? Yes, and what it would do. Or if you send... or driverless cars or robots, and if a driverless car hits somebody, right? What?
Yes.
Who's responsible?
Exactly right.
Is that part of the black box problem?
It is definitely part of the problem. You know, so just think about how one other example. Some years back, IBM rolled out a supercomputer support for cancer doctors, and it's called Watson for oncology, IBM Watson, the AI powered, you know, and the thing was this supercomputer crunched medical data of cancer patients, you know, to help doctors support their, increase the accuracy of the diagnosis and so on. Mm. So, but after a little while of trialing it, they kind of found out that, you know, when the analysis of the, of the machine, the supercomputer, agreed with the doctors, it was fine. But whenever analysis did not agree with the doctors always insisted that it was simply wrong.
Ah.
You know? And that's because they don't know how it works.
Yeah.
And therefore they don't trust it.
Okay. You know? I see that your point is.
Yeah. So coming to a more simple kind of scenario, you know, so you know Amazon, YouTube, Netflix, they're always pushing recommendations to you, right? They push content to you on the basis of your previous choices.
May my Spotify pull out songs for me every week.
You know, like, there you go. Yeah. So then you gotta ask yourself, like, how do these things sort of make you feel? Mm. What are the changes in your life that are affected by the fact that the computer seems to know you well?
Yeah.
You know, and knows you. And do you feel spied on? Do you feel better served? Do they lead to addictions? You know, all of those things.
Mm.
So just a couple of days ago, there was an article on the Gospel Coalition website in which it's about Netflix. And they said, it called it AI-fueled addictions. And also it says, this is the power of suggestion. It keeps you hooked before you know it. It's way past midnight and you've spent 6 hours in front of the TV and you ought to have gone to bed 2 hours ago, but you didn't. You know, and the author, you know, whose name is Brett McCracken, he says something pretty wise. He said he hasn't sworn off Netflix, you know, but there is quality, edifying, or simply entertaining
programs,
content
yes.
on it. Mm-hmm. But he says the key is intentionality.
Mm.
He says don't just open Netflix to watch something. Open it sparingly for a specific purpose.
Mm.
And he adds, when we aren't going somewhere, we'll go anywhere. And the anywheres of the internet are rarely good for us.
Yeah, they are really anywhere, isn't it?
So so coming back to the black box thing, maybe the black box really refers to this whole idea that a human being is lacking intention when we engage with technology, you know. And that is one of the key means by which we should engage technology.
Mm.
Otherwise, we're going to allow it to lead us by the nose.
That's
and
true.
And we'll end That's up true. Places That's that true. We that That's are not true. Good for us.
And that is something that everyone can do because we all have... if we have the mental capacity, we can choose and we can decide. That's the singular power, the power of choice, right?
Yeah.
So we can be intentional about our choices.
Yes.
And at the end of the day, most of us cannot explain how tech works.
Yes.
But we can explain to ourselves why we make the choices we
did. Good point. There you go.
Okay. How about blockchain and cryptocurrency? You know, we live in a world everybody wants to cash in. How should the Christian be responding to this whole new
wave that's coming? It's quite a different area than AI.
Yes,
but
it is.
An emerging one and one that's very much in the limelight.
Yes.
In case, you know, listeners don't really know what blockchain is.
Yes.
I mean, it's essentially a technology and a philosophy that digitizes, that decentralizes, that democratizes, and that socializes everything that is of value to humanity. Okay.
Yeah.
So
at least that's the philosophy.
That's the philosophy of it, you know. So it's decentralized ledgers, you know. And I would say that cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin are one of the most high-profile use cases or applications of blockchain. And that's because people see Bitcoin as being an asset that's worth a lot of money. Oh, Bitcoin, $20,000 for Bitcoin when you could have bought it for 50 cents 15 years ago, blah, blah, you know. So but that's just one part of that whole realm where human beings really just start to act out of character, and that's to do with human greed.
Yeah.
That's to do with human greed, do with speculation.
Right.
And I don't want to talk too much about that. I wanted to talk a little bit more about other use cases of blockchain.
Okay.
You know, they are quite unique. So, I mean, some of the key characteristics of blockchain are that the data is stored in blocks called hashes or chains. And then when it is stored not in one place on a network, it's distributed and duplicated over an entire network. And then two other interesting and quite unique characteristics of blockchain are that there's a consensus between participants. Everything you do on the blockchain must be verified by a majority of the nodes or of the computers that are on the network. And then the other thing is that execution is done by way of smart contracts, which are just computer programs that automatically if A happens, then B happens. If B happens, then C happens, and so on. And so on. Yeah. So blockchain provided the answer in many ways to digital trust. Because it records important information in a public space. It doesn't allow anybody to remove it. So it's transparent, and then it's time-stamped, and then it's decentralized. And I think that's the heart of the blockchain technology. It sounds really good, right? Sounds really
it does.
Cool.
Yeah.
You know, but some of the downsides are there, and we're beginning to see them as well. You know, one is that because of the supercomputing power that's needed to run networks of blockchain, it's actually led to a discernible global warming impact. Would you believe it? That in China, for example, you know, there are entire farms, acres and acres of supercomputers, they're just going there and eating up electricity to mine Bitcoin. And it's so bad that apparently, they predict that temperature around China will rise by an average of 2 degrees by 2033.
That's a huge thing. 2 degrees.
Exactly. So there are like entire swaths of land that look like an alien landscape where people just supercomputers are. But they also need super cooling sort of mechanisms to run and so on. Yeah. So that's one sort of interesting worldwide impact of blockchain and running blockchains. The other thing is quite interesting is that blockchain actually makes censorship impossible.
Yeah,
because of the fact that all the information is publicly available and it cannot be altered or removed without someone, without everybody agreeing.
Yeah.
So, you know, all of the past information can be supplemented on a blockchain or changed with permission, but it can't be removed entirely.
Right.
And I think that's something that's quite interesting, you know. Is it right that everybody's life ought to be put up somewhere there where people can see?
But I don't understand. That's not that much different with currently what we have with the internet. Whatever you put up there is also, except for that, the earlier part you mentioned about how it's stored and the sense of security that it has, as well as the consensual applications.
Yeah. You're right. No, so so gigabytes and terabytes of data, more information has been uploaded onto the internet in the past 1 year than existed in the world, in the history of the world, from 2018 and before.
Wow. Okay. So, Aaron, I'm still a little bit thick about blockchain. Maybe you can give us some concrete applications of it.
Yeah, sure. I think, as I mentioned just now, it is still an emerging technology, and there are different people who are working on different projects and real-world applications that will improve the lot of society. There's even a movement called Blockchain for Good.
Wow. Okay.
You know, one of the projects that impresses me a lot is one that is actually started by the World Bank together with Microsoft and Accenture. It's called ID 2020. It's a global partnership that develops the digital identity of more than 1 billion people who cannot prove who they are. We are referring to the refugees, you know. So because of the circumstances that they are in, war, civil war, and whatever, they when they go somewhere, they can't prove
who they are. The papers and
no papers, and so they can't get aid, they can't get jobs, stuff like that. And blockchain is behind this particular movement, so that on a very secure platform, people will be able to prove who they are and thereby be allowed to gain political, economic, social opportunities.
Oh, that's a very important project.
So that's a very, very important project as well. You know, there's another project that has to do with using blockchain for each and every person on Earth to own your own carbon footprint.
Oh, so not everybody would be happy about that, but
You know what the on the flip side, you know, and what will incentivize you to get on this is that, you know, you socialize your carbon footprint.
Yeah,
it is on the blockchain. you can actually maybe trade it. You get benefits from sort of reducing your carbon footprint, you know, and it incentivizes people to reduce their carbon footprint and to live responsibly. So, yeah, other cases abound, but, you know, there's also a company that tracks and authenticates diamonds using blockchain technology, and they just want to enforce the ethical trade of diamonds.
Yeah, that's also very important.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, okay. Not that diamonds are... Never mind. not necessarily a girl's best friend. Mm-hmm. Wow, okay, because it's just carbon, really. Carbon under a lot of stress.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. Okay, so, you know, with technology and all that, right, one of the things that sort of, like, overshadows all of these in a way is, as Christians, we've been taught about the end times.
Mm.
And, you know, one of the popular notions is there's be this Antichrist who's going to rule the world. And we're all secretly worried that all the big data going on, all the information we are relinquishing, whether it's to blockchain or others, may one day be harvested and used against us by the Antichrist, you know. it does make us feel rather sort of vulnerable and a bit afraid.
It does.
Is there, can we have a more grounded response to this, grounded understanding of things?
I like what you say when you say our response should be grounded. I mean, you know, there is a history in certain parts of the world where people sort of get off the grid on purpose. Many of them are Christian or religious sects or cults even, where they sort of don't trust the government, for example. So they want to live in small communities.
Mm.
They get off the grid so they don't participate in the economy.
Yeah.
And they grow their own food and blah, blah, blah. Mm. So, I mean, that's a pretty reactionary and paranoid way of dealing with the idea that technology and being connected one with the other is a cause for concern, and you know, and you can fear harm coming upon you and your loved ones if you are too plugged in to community and other people. And that's one extreme, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I think, because technology is just so pervasive now, everybody needs to use phones. Everybody needs a bank account.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's just inevitable that we don't have, it's not easy at all. It may be even impossible for us to unplug wholly.
Completely, yeah.
It is much better for us, I feel, to learn how to unplug wisely and the places and the means which we do away with. So as I mentioned on a previous session when we spoke, that I know of technology leaders who have actually chosen to stay off social media.
Yeah.
But they still use other technologies well, you know,
the medical technology. This brings us back to the point we made earlier about intentionality.
Intentionality and wisdom, you know, and because it is very clear right now that technology is not neutral.
Yeah.
It can lead to all kinds of harms
yes.
to the individual and to society. There's even a website run by the Center for... Human technologies or humane technologies that keeps a ledger of harms.
Yes, a ledger of harms. So it's a center of humane tech.
That's right, right, yeah.
Yeah. So that actually, good that you mentioned the Center for Humane Tech. That is offering an alternative vision in some ways. But like you say, they're not saying everybody get off. But saying, okay, there's this train, everybody's on this train, but maybe we can all check where the train is heading.
Yes.
Maybe we can all slow the train down. Can we give some instructions to the train operators? Can we create feedback loop so that they're also hearing us?
Yes.
And can we all speak up
yes.
if we don't like how we're feeling, the scenery is going too fast, whatever.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's quite interesting. Do you think then Christians should be on board with these sort of things? Maybe
absolutely,
a bit more.
Absolutely, yeah. Because thought leadership is needed. Education, self-awareness is important. And then action. First of all, individual action, and then concerted action.
Right.
You know, so the center that you mentioned, Center for Humane Tech, founded by Tristan Harris, I know of it. He was the design ethicist at Google.
Yeah.
Is it an interesting job?
Yeah, exactly, right?
Design ethicist. And I like how he articulated a vision of technology innovation as really harnessing our collective power to reverse human downgrading and to elevate our shared humanity.
Yeah.
So he says we need to design humane technology. And that's really something that we all need to get on board, especially as Christians, because we realize
and that's
that
a really big shift, because it's instead a big of shift. Building our lives around technology, and in some ways it's a bit of a golden calf.
Yes.
Right? We are kind of like subservient to it. We are saying now that, hey, you know, humans should be in center. And of course, for the Christian, God should be in the center, the humans. Yes. And then whatever technology we develop should serve us in such a way that helps us to be more human.
Yes.
And more Christ-like, if possible, even. And of course, remind us that we are just creatures living under God.
Yes. And so, Tristan Harris hasn't articulated it in religious terms at all. Yes. But I do think that they are entirely persuasive and very much in line with Christian values. You know, and for example, he has pinpointed six areas of human sensitivity to take into consideration when we design technology. So he says the emotional and physical health of the human being. You know, that's one. We need to be sensitive to it and consider it. Then the whole idea also of attention, what takes our mind and captivates us and, you know, drains our attention and holds us in its power. That's also something that human beings are prone to, to those addictions and making idols of things that make us feel good or that we can hope in. He also talks about sense-making, and that's really interesting. I mean, so it kind of goes into the whole area of information and truth and authority.
Yeah.
How do we make sense of the world, you know, with the information that is being shared by technology? Now, he talks about decision making. So about aligning our intentions with our actions so that we get the outcomes that we want and that are good for us. He talks about social reasoning, which is basically about realizing that, you know, how we navigate personal relationships is important. So avoiding toxic environments where or echo chambers where we polarize discussions, kind of. And things like that. So, I think it's I'm looking forward to more thought leadership from people like Tristan Harris and others like him, because we need to remember that technology is ought to be humane.
Yes.
You know, in Singapore, the government has actually articulated some ethical guidelines on AI.
Yeah, that's encouraging.
And one of them, they don't use the word humane technology, but they do use the term human-centric. So we've got, not so long ago, our Deputy Prime Minister talking about our aspirations to be a smart nation, that we will be a smart government, a smart economy with smart people. And AI is a key and fundamental technology for us to get there. So he said, you know, there are two broad principles about AI development that we will cling to. One is that AI must be explainable, transparent, and fair to consumers.
Right.
So he's talking a little bit about the black box issue.
Yes.
And secondly, that AI solutions ought to be human-centric. So
kudos,
but they haven't been fleshed out.
Yeah,
you know, so they all.
And I think it probably, you know, with that commitment, just slows everything down.
Absolutely, yes.
Because everybody now must go back to the drawing board and say, really, did this meet all these criteria? Which is good. I think one of the difficulties and one of our fascinations is with speed. Technology abets us in that area.
Yes.
And it's addictive as well in some ways. Speed, hence roller coasters. I think forcing us to slow down is wonderful. I just, you know, when hearing you talk about Center for Humane Tech and all that, I just wish it was the church at the forefront.
So do I.
Saying, you know, why can't we have this vision? We have so much technology being used. Let's make sure that we compete in the sphere to bring out human brilliance and to bring out solid, loving relationships. I mean, it would be great to have a sermon like that. It would be great for churches to be, and youth groups and all that, to sit down and brainstorm on that and think about it rather than design another nice meme just to publicize the next youth activity, perhaps.
That is true.
Not that that's not valid, but I think our people have enough exposure and training to be able to jump onto this open invitation from our Deputy Prime Minister to say, you know, actually, maybe we should free up time and effort and maybe even really just encourage the younger generation to get on board on this and shape the world very differently from how it's been handed to them.
Yeah. I just want to mention really quickly, I mean, this emerging field in digital humanities, you know, called digital theology, you know, and that's really the examination of how Christians ought to think and use and apply technology.
Yeah.
And acknowledging that we actually now do already live in a digital age. Mm. So in the Christian X conference that took place last year, you know, one of the key speakers, the Reverend Pete Phillips from the UK, kind of mentioned, you know, that, you know, in the past it was easy to draw a line between human and machine.
Yeah.
But today we are all simultaneously online and offline.
Yeah.
And he says that, he even says that cyberspace is sacred space. Why? Because God is everywhere, including in cyberspace, where many of us are.
Mm.
You know, so Psalm 24, he quoted, the earth is the Lord's
yeah.
and everything in it. You know, so we, if we are going to be in that space, we have to trust that, you know, it's not a place that the Lord has asked us to abandon, but rather for us to steward. You know,
and
Genesis, that marvelous book, is just full of the principles of stewardship.
Yeah.
And stewardship is one of the primary ways that God has called all of us to live as Christians.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and it means that we have to understand and accept that God created everything, that He owns everything, that He delegates some things, and we, human beings, we steward these things for saving, for giving, for helping, and we will have to answer to the Lord one day.
Yes.
You know, like in the parable of the talents emphasized over and over again, Matthew 25 and other places, we will have to answer for what we have done with these things that God has placed in our hands.
Wow.
And I just want to emphasize again that, yeah, when we think about Christianity and culture and technology, our posture should be one of stewardship.
That is the starting point, isn't it?
Great starting point.
It's because we are stewarding, and to steward well, you really need to have a vision.
Absolutely.
And that vision that guides how you use your resources and how you galvanize everybody to come on board.
Amen.
For a worthy vision, which is to lead everybody, to bring out human brilliance. I like my vision.
Super.
And solid loving relationships.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, all new inventions, as a former Fuller president said, all new inventions lead to new conventions. So whatever we create, whatever we fail to steward, or whatever we steward well, turns out to then shape our lives, because it creates new ways of doing things and living and making sense of things.
Yeah.
So all the best to all of you listening in. I'm sure you guys all use tech. I hope this episode gives you lots of things to think about. Don't run onto the Bitcoin bandwagon just yet. Don't be afraid of the second coming. And please be intentional about your tech use. Thank you so much, Aaron, for being here.
My pleasure. God bless.
Thank you for listening in. We hope you've been encouraged with some new thoughts on faith and life integration. You can find us on the Cathedral app, iTunes, Spotify, or at cathedral.org.sg/podcast. Be sure to join us again.